Welcome back, everybody. Today, we're taking a deep dive into the Gospel of Mark, specifically looking at the concept of discipleship as it's presented there. And let me tell you, it's a wild ride. To guide us, we've got some really interesting excerpts from a lecture by Dr. Mark Jennings. You know, Mark's gospel, it's kind of unique, right?
Oh, absolutely.
It's known for its fast-paced style.
Yeah, it's like an action movie almost.
Right. But it's also interesting how it portrays the disciples.
Yeah.
They don't always come off looking so great.
That's right. They're very human.
Very human. So it makes you wonder, what's Mark trying to tell us about what it really means to follow Jesus?
That's a great question. And I think one of the things Mark is doing is highlighting the huge contrast between Jesus' teachings and the disciples' actions.
Right. It's like, look, following Jesus, this isn't a walk in the park.
Not at all. It's a challenging path.
It is. Like, take Mark chapter 10. For the third time, Jesus predicts his own suffering and death.
Oh, yeah.
And you'd think by now the disciples would get it, but their reaction is still so far off.
Yeah, they just don't seem to grasp the gravity of the situation.
Mm.
And you know, that detail about it being the third prediction, that's really significant.
Okay, how so?
Mark is using that to emphasize just how crucial this theme is in his gospel. And he even includes some details here that are unique to his account.
Oh, interesting. Like
what? Like the fact that Jesus is going to be handed over to the Gentiles, the mocking and spitting, the flogging. It's really brutal.
Wow. It's intense. And I know there's this debate among scholars about whether these predictions actually happened as recorded or if they were added in later.
Oh, yeah. That's a big question in biblical scholarship.
But Dr. Jennings, he argues that they are authentic.
Okay, interesting.
And he points to the title Son of Man, which is the title Jesus uses, and also the word kill that Jesus uses instead of crucify.
Oh, that's fascinating. It's like these little linguistic clues can help us unlock the historical puzzle.
Yeah, it's almost like a detective story.
It is. And Dr. Jennings' reasoning makes sense. Because you figure if this were added later, after the fact, you would think the language would reflect the crucifixion more directly. But instead, we get these raw, almost shocking details.
Yeah. So we've got this really heavy prediction. And then the disciples are traveling with Jesus to Jerusalem.
Yeah, the tension is building.
And Mark describes them, the disciples, as being astonished. Mm-hmm. And those who are following behind, they were afraid.
I mean, can you imagine? Put yourself on that road with them.
Yeah.
Heading to Jerusalem. The heart of everything.
Right.
Religious power, political power.
It's the center of the world for them in a sense.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And you know, Jesus has been talking about this journey since chapter 8. And then you have Peter's messianic confession and all that. It just really makes you wonder, were they expecting some kind of takeover?
Right. Like a political upheaval. Maybe even the disciples themselves were expecting that.
It's possible. And so Dr. Jennings suggests that maybe their fear wasn't just about Jesus suffering.
Okay.
But about what that might mean for them.
Like, if Jesus is challenging these huge power structures, are we going to get caught in the crossfire?
Exactly. It's a dangerous game they're playing, whether they fully realize it or not.
So that fear, that uncertainty, I mean, that really sets the stage for what happens next. Because then in Mark chapter 10, verses 35 through 45, we see James and John, two of Jesus' closest disciples, they make this incredibly bold request.
This is where it gets really interesting. This is the part that always makes me wonder about human nature.
It's juicy, right? They ask to sit on Jesus' right and left hand in his glory.
It's like, hey, could we be your right hand men?
Yeah. But it's interesting because Matthew tells the story a little differently. In Matthew's gospel, it's their mother who makes the request.
Oh, that's right. I hadn't thought about that.
Why do you think Mark leaves that part out?
I think Mark really wants to get to the heart of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's still ultimately James and John's ambition.
Right.
Regardless of who's actually voicing it. And another thing that strikes me is that Peter's completely missing from this whole exchange.
Yeah. He's usually part of this inner circle, right? Him, James, and John.
Exactly. But not this time. It makes you wonder, was there some kind of rivalry going on? Was their ambition maybe a little bit self-serving?
It's like they're playing power politics, right?
Yeah, it's like they're already jockeying for the best positions in Jesus' kingdom.
Assuming there's going to be some kind of earthly kingdom.
Yeah, there's that assumption. But Jesus, of course, he's always one step ahead.
Always.
He throws them a curveball.
He does. What does he say?
He asks them, are you able to drink the cup that I drink? Or to be baptized with the baptism with which I am baptized.
Ah, yes. Those metaphors.
Yeah. And those metaphors, the cup and the baptism, they both point to the suffering and death that Jesus is facing. It's like he's saying, are you willing to go through what I'm about to go through?
And it's not just about suffering, is it? It's about transformation.
Right. It's about a complete change, a full immersion in his experience. Drinking the cup, being baptized, it's intense imagery.
Intense. And Dr. Jennings, he pointed out something interesting. He said that these metaphors, they carry this sense of fullness.
Oh.
Drinking the cup, it signifies internal change.
I see.
While baptism, that suggests an external surrender, like being completely submerged in this new reality of suffering and service. He's not making it sound easy, that's for sure.
No, not at all. He's being completely honest with them about the cost of following him.
And of course, James and John, ever the optimists.
Yeah, bless their hearts.
They say, we are able, but you get the feeling they have no idea what they're signing up for.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of youthful naivete there.
Right.
But what I find fascinating is that Jesus actually affirms them. He says, you will drink the cup that I drink, and with the baptism with which I am baptized, you will be baptized. But notice, he doesn't promise them those seats at his right and left hand.
Oh, that's interesting. It's like he's saying, yeah, you're going to face hardships. You're going to experience suffering, but don't expect to be rewarded for it. That must have been a blow to their egos.
Oh, I'm sure it was.
Right.
And then he goes on to make it even clearer. He says, but to sit at my right hand or at my left is not mine to give, but it is for those for whom it has been prepared.
So it's not even up to him. It's God the Father who ultimately decides who gets those positions. Talk about a reality check.
Right. It really takes the wind out of their sails, doesn't it? And here's something else to consider, the irony of it all. Because the only other time in Mark that we see people on Jesus's right and left.
Where is that?
It's during the crucifixion.
Whoa. Okay, so the places of honor in Jesus's kingdom, they're not marked by worldly power.
Not at all.
They're marked by sacrifice.
Exactly. It's this complete reversal of expectations.
It really is. And then we've got the other disciples, and they're indignant at James and John for this request. But Dr. Jennings suggests that their anger maybe wasn't really about understanding what true discipleship is.
Yeah.
It was probably more like jealousy. Like, hey, why do they get the best seats?
It's like classic sibling rivalry, but playing out among Jesus' followers.
And it's like they're completely missing the point. But Jesus, always the teacher, right?
Yeah.
He uses this whole episode to give them this lesson about what genuine leadership looks like.
Such a powerful moment. This is where we really start to see the heart of Mark's message on discipleship.
Okay, I'm ready for this message. Let's dive in.
It's interesting, right? This whole thing with James and John, it seems to fit into this pattern we see throughout Mark.
What do you mean?
Well, the disciples, they often act out of self-interest.
Shh.
You know? And it shows that they just don't quite get it. You know what I mean?
Right.
And then Jesus uses those moments to teach them and correct them.
It's like they keep failing these discipleship pop quizzes. But I mean, to be fair, Jesus does set a pretty high bar.
He does, yeah.
Yeah.
But his teaching is so profound, like in Mark 10, verses 42 through 45, where he draws this really sharp contrast between how Gentile rulers operate.
Mm-hmm.
And how his followers should behave.
Yeah, he's basically saying Gentile rulers, they're all about power and domination, but his disciples should be about service and humility.
Exactly. It's like a total flipping of the script.
Yeah.
He even uses this phrase, it must not be like that among you. You know, just to really drive home the point.
It's so interesting because he then goes on to lay out this amazing reversal of values.
Oh, yeah.
He says, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant. And whoever wants to be first among you must be a slave to all. I mean, that's powerful stuff.
It is. It's like he's turning all of our ideas about success and leadership completely upside down.
Yeah. And then to really drive home the point, he uses himself as the ultimate example.
Right. And that's where we get to that really pivotal verse.
Yeah.
Mark chapter 10, verse 45.
Let's hear it.
He says, for even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. I mean, there's so much packed into that one statement.
Okay, yeah, break it down for me. So we've got the Son of Man title again, right? Which points to Jesus's divine authority.
Right. But here he's connecting that authority to service. You know, he's not saying that the Son of Man won't be honored or exalted, but that his very purpose, his mission, is to serve.
Mm.
And the way that he serves is by giving his life as a ransom for many.
Okay, so what's the significance of that word, ransom?
Well, if you think back to ancient times, a ransom was basically a payment to free someone from captivity or slavery.
Okay.
And Jesus, he uses this image to describe his own sacrifice. He's saying he came to give his life as a payment to set us free from the bondage of sin and death.
Wow. So it's like we were held captive and Jesus paid the price to set us free.
That's a really powerful way to think about it. It makes you rethink what sacrifice really means.
It does. And Dr. Jennings, he makes this really interesting connection here between the Son of Man and the suffering servant that we see in Isaiah.
Oh, yeah, that's a great point. In Isaiah chapter 53, it describes this figure who suffers and dies for the sins of others. It's such a moving passage.
Yeah, it is.
And Dr. Jennings suggests that Jesus is very intentionally blending these two concepts, the powerful Son of Man and the suffering servant. He's the divine ruler who comes to serve. And he's the one who takes on our suffering and pays the price for our freedom. It's just mind-blowing when you really think about it.
It really is. I mean, it just redefines what it means to be powerful and what it means to be a leader.
It does. Yeah. It turns everything on its head. And then Mark reinforces this message in the very next story.
Oh, which one is that?
This takes place as Jesus and the disciples are approaching Jericho, and it's the healing of Bartimaeus, the blind beggar.
Right. And blindness in Mark, if I remember correctly, sometimes it's used to symbolize spiritual insight.
Exactly. And so we have this blind man who actually seems to understand Jesus better than the disciples do.
It's kind of ironic, right?
It really is. And what's also fascinating is that Mark actually names Bartimaeus, which is unusual.
Really?
Most of the people that Jesus heals, they're anonymous. Dr. Jennings thinks this might mean that Bartimaeus was a well-known figure in the early church.
Oh, wow.
Maybe even someone who played a role in spreading the gospel.
So he's not just some random guy in the story. He's someone whose story had real weight and impact.
Exactly. And the way he cries out to Jesus is just so powerful. He says, Son of David, Jesus, have mercy on me.
Powerful, yeah. And that's actually the only time in Mark that the title Son of David is used explicitly, and it's coming from a blind beggar.
Right. It's this amazing declaration of faith. He recognizes Jesus as the Messiah, as the descendant of King David. It's incredible.
It's almost like a parallel to Peter's confession, but this time it's the crowd who tries to silence him.
Yeah, it's like, hey, be quiet. Don't bother him.
Right. They're like, don't bother him with your problems. He's got bigger fish to fry.
Exactly. But Bartimaeus, he refuses to be silenced. He keeps calling out, showing just this incredible persistence, this deep faith.
That's beautiful. And that's what gets Jesus' attention.
And Jesus heals him and he tells him, go your way. Your faith has healed you.
But Bartimaeus, he doesn't just walk away, right?
No, he doesn't. Mark tells us that Bartimaeus began to follow him on the road.
He becomes a disciple.
Yes. He chooses to join Jesus on the way to Jerusalem, even though he knows what's coming.
Wow, that's a powerful image. It's such a contrast to the other disciples. This blind man, who has just received his sight, he seems to see things more clearly than those who have been with Jesus all along.
It's really thought-provoking, isn't it? It makes you question what it really means to see.
It does. And speaking of seeing things clearly, this brings us to a very pivotal moment, the triumphal entry into Jerusalem.
Things really start to accelerate here.
They do. It's like the energy of the story really picks up. You know, Jesus sends his disciples to find a colt. He gives them very specific instructions.
Mm-hmm.
And then he rides into Jerusalem in such a deliberate way. You can just tell he's orchestrating this entire event.
Mark really emphasizes the intentionality of it all.
Yeah.
You know, Jesus isn't just stumbling upon a colt and deciding to ride it.
Right.
He's entering Jerusalem in a way that very deliberately connects to Old Testament imagery and prophecy.
Right, like Solomon riding a donkey, you know, as a symbol of his kingship.
Yeah.
It points to that Davidic lineage that Bartimaeus just acknowledged.
Exactly. It's like Jesus is presenting himself as the rightful heir to David's throne, fulfilling those ancient promises.
But then there's also that connection to Zechariah 9.9.
Oh, yeah, the prophecy about the king coming in peace.
Right, which describes this humble king riding on a donkey, bringing peace and salvation.
And even though Mark doesn't quote Zechariah directly, that imagery is so powerful.
Mm-hmm.
Jesus is presenting himself as the fulfillment of this messianic prophecy, the one who comes in the name of the Lord.
And then you've got the crowd's response. You know, they're laying down their cloaks and palm branches, shouting, Hosanna, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Blessed is coming kingdom of our father David. Hosanna in the highest. I mean, talk about a scene.
Oh, it's electric. Yeah. Just this raw energy and excitement. But it makes you wonder, you know, what do they really understand? Were they hailing him as the Messiah who would overthrow Rome and establish an earthly kingdom? Or were they just kind of caught up in the moment? You know, just celebrating this popular figure.
Yeah, it's the big question, right? Dr. Jennings mentioned that the word Hosanna had actually changed in meaning over time.
Really?
Yeah, it went from being a plea for salvation to being a more general pilgrim's greeting. So maybe their shouts were more celebratory than theological.
Maybe. But regardless, I think Mark is highlighting this as a crucial moment in Jesus' journey. He's entering Jerusalem, you know, embodying both kingship and humility, triumph and sacrifice. It's just such a complex scene.
It really is. And then after all that excitement, we get this strangely quiet scene where Jesus goes into the temple and Mark just says he looked around at everything and then he leaves with his disciples. It's almost anticlimactic.
Yeah, but that phrase looked around, that's actually pretty significant.
Oh, how so?
Well, it's not just a casual glance.
Yeah.
You know, the Greek word that's used here implies judgment, evaluation. Mm-hmm. Dr. Jennings actually compares it to Jeremiah chapter 7, verse 11, where God is evaluating the temple and getting ready to pronounce judgment.
So there's this sense of foreboding. Like, even though it's a seemingly simple action, there's something much bigger about to happen.
Exactly. It foreshadows that conflict that's about to break out between Jesus and the religious authorities.
Oh, okay. So we've got all of this contrast building. The disciples, they're still struggling to understand what Jesus's mission is really all about.
Yeah.
And Jesus is steadily moving toward Jerusalem, you know, knowing what awaits him.
Mm-hmm.
And now we've got this tension brewing at the temple. I'm ready to see where this all leads.
Me too.
It really does feel like Mark is building up to this clash of expectations. You know, on the one hand, we have the disciples who are still trying to figure out who is Jesus really and what does it actually mean to follow him.
Right.
And then on the other hand, there's Jesus moving steadily towards Jerusalem. He knows what's coming, but he's totally committed to his mission.
It's like he's got this laser focus.
Yeah.
And I think it's a really brilliant way to highlight just how radical Jesus's message is.
Yeah.
Because by showing the disciples and how they don't understand, Mark forces us to confront our own assumptions about discipleship.
Mm-hmm.
It's like he's saying, look, this isn't about power or glory or getting ahead. It's about something much deeper.
Mm.
And it's going to come at a cost.
You know, it's actually kind of a relief to see that even the people who were closest to Jesus, you know, they messed up sometimes. It makes the whole idea of discipleship feel a little more attainable. You know what I mean?
Oh, for sure.
Like, if they could stumble and make mistakes, well, it's okay if I don't have it all figured out either.
Right, exactly. I think that's one of the things that makes Mark's gospel so powerful. He doesn't shy away from the hard truths. It's not a sugar-coated version of faith, you know?
Right.
It's honest about the challenges and the sacrifices and even the failures that come with following Jesus.
Yeah. Like that moment at the temple we talked about where Jesus looks around at everything. It seems so simple at first.
Right.
But then you pointed out how that phrase actually suggests judgment. Like he's evaluating. Kind of like in Jeremiah, where God is about to pronounce judgment on the temple. It just creates this sense of unease, like something big is about to happen.
Exactly. It's like the calm before the storm.
And you can't really talk about Mark's gospel without mentioning how he portrays the disciples during Jesus's passion.
Yeah, it's tough to read sometimes.
They seem so completely caught off guard, even though Jesus had warned them over and over again about what was going to happen. It's like, guys, didn't you get the memo?
Well, their reactions really show the very human side of discipleship. I mean, they're not superhuman. They're just ordinary people who have been thrust into these really extraordinary circumstances. They're afraid and confused, and ultimately they abandon Jesus when he needs them the most, which is, you know, heartbreaking, but also very relatable.
It's a humbling reminder that even the people who are closest to Jesus weren't immune to fear and doubt. I mean, think about Peter denying Jesus 3 times. If he could fall apart like that, I mean, what does that say about the rest of us?
Right. It shows us that discipleship is a journey, not a destination. You know, there will be times when we fall short, when we give in to fear, when we make mistakes.
Mm.
But even in those moments, there's grace.
And hope. I mean, like at the end of Mark, you know, when the women at the tomb, they're told that Jesus is risen and that he's going to meet his disciples in Galilee.
Mm.
It's this really open ending.
Yeah.
And it kind of leaves you wondering what happens next.
What's going to happen to these guys?
Yeah. Like, will they finally get their act together and become those bold witnesses that Jesus called them to be?
It's a question that resonates even today.
It does.
We're all still trying to figure out what it means to follow Jesus in a world that often feels very hostile to his message.
So as we kind of wrap up our deep dive into Mark, I guess I have to ask, if Jesus, the Son of God, came to serve, what does that mean for us? How do we actually live that out in our everyday lives, in our families, our work, our communities?
That's the challenge Mark leaves us with. And I think, you know, it's not necessarily about those grand gestures, but it's about those small acts of service, those everyday moments where we choose to put other people's needs ahead of our own, even when it's hard.
So it's about embodying humility, seeking justice, extending grace, even when it's not easy.
Exactly. And we don't have to do it alone, just like those first disciples. You know, we need each other. We need community. We need support. We need encouragement as we navigate all the ups and downs of following Jesus.
Well, that wraps up our deep dive into discipleship in Mark. I hope you found it as thought-provoking as I did. And remember, keep seeking, keep questioning, and keep diving deep into the mysteries of faith.